Monster Mash. Monster Mash. Monster Mash.
Monster Mash.
The reason why I'm laughing is given the trajectory of releases, that this Monster Mash, this podcast that starts with Monster Mash is probably going to drop in December and make in no December. Sense. But it's cool.
Santa's coming to town. I have to do the jingles 2 months ahead of time. Yeah,
good recovery.
Because they're backlogged.
Good recovery. Awesome.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome back, everyone.
Hello.
Yeah, thanks for joining, everyone, and thanks for joining PJ. This is the third of our Let's Get series talking about let's get scaling and let's scale this thing, talking about design system years 2 to 3 and beyond, which I believe, PJ, you're in that area. We are in that area on my design system team and my previous design system at Disney, also years 2 and 3. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's right. It's almost the end of basically 3.5 years.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Yeah. So I think we're somewhere on the business design system, I think somewhere in 3+ years as well. And we are beyond initially selling the thing. We are beyond the initial steps of adoption, but you kind of find that we have to do the stuff all over again on an annual basis. And stepping back to an episode that we did about feedback and surveying, and before we jumped on this call, we talked a little bit about surveys. And when we have done surveys in the past, we find that sometimes adoption isn't as good as we want it to be. And why? There's various reasons that come to mind. Documentation could be one, education. So I've come to find in years 3, you sort of need to continue to double down and keep refreshing and keep a good cadence of keeping your shit up to date, whether that's your doc site or your training, and really trying to figure out how you could evolve this stuff to even reach more people.
Yeah, it's I think a lot of folks are in the constant cycle of prove your value, show that you're important. Why should we keep funding you? Is the design system done yet? That's always a fun one. And that is, you know, that can be a tough cycle to go through. Funny enough, the thing I'm trying to work on is to work towards removing that cycle altogether. And that's something we can talk about. I mean, who knows if I'm going to be successful, but that's what I'm trying to work through is, you know, if you're constantly spending a portion of your time proving your value, you're not creating value because you're busy proving value. So how do you get out of that cycle so you can have more time just to do the work that you need to do? So it'll be a fun conversation because there's been a lot of movement, at least like mental movement for myself in the last month or two.
Yeah, maybe it's involving more of doing the work and then making sure that you have a good cadence on presenting the outcomes and then showcasing that and making sure, obviously, to shed light to all the team members that have participated and are good faith, good actors that are following this case. So being able to build those advocates and making sure that you're out there continuously hitting the pavement and sort of hitting the outreach bar.
Yeah, I think comms is a big part of it. However, I would argue that if you are continually having to communicate your value, that infers that people don't necessarily immediately understand the value if they have to continually be reminded. And so part of what I'm trying to work on is trying to tweak, adjust, move the culture and the way of thinking and the philosophical approach to where it's just understood. We don't ask ourselves every day, why do we need a design tool to do work? We don't ask ourselves why we need a laptop to do work. Why? Because it's so ingrained into the day-to-day work that we just understand that that's what happens and we've moved on. That's my goal for design systems. And like I said, we're not anywhere there, but if you don't work on it, it sure as hell isn't going to happen. So that's what we've been trying to work towards in the last few months.
Yeah, I think also in years 2 to 3, you start getting some more product ownership, I would assume. You yourself as a product owner, previously I was a product owner. There is more involved in terms of writing, being able to write out strategic plans and being able to write out OKRs. That's something else that we talked about before we jumped on here. And being able to outline what you would like to impact and what needle you would like to move, and the fun of 6 months from now, seeing if you're able to turn that a little bit. Yeah. And if you can, there you go. And being able to work with other teams as well to see how you could also improve their OKRs. I think that's something that comes in years 2 to 3. And by this point, hopefully, you would have gotten invited to participate in other teams' roadmapping sessions, possibly, and demonstrating value in that sense, and demonstrating how you, with the mandate of using the system, you could be an accelerant towards them hitting their goals.
Sure. Can we do it more through new components or better components?
I would argue that we're helping every team. Absolutely.
Every team's OKRs, that's the big win of building out an experience. We already are.
Value doesn't go away.
If the components are built, and we have established the fact that we're speeding up engineering and design velocity, then we already are. It persists. And so every time a designer doesn't need to design a new button, or an engineer doesn't need to build out a new button, you're providing value. And so that's, I think, finding a way to communicate that. But going back to having it be a known understanding, is trying to come up ways to influence, tweak processes and expectations within the company to where systems are just a day-to-day role. They just play a day-to-day role in terms of how the work is done. Not that people have to use it, but it's a consideration. You know, it's where they start. And they may not end there, but it's a starting point to see if that can work. And if it does, then great. Teams have saved themselves a lot of time. But that's the thing that I kind of make the case for, is we're already helping these teams out just by all the patterns and components and guidelines that we've provided up to this point.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, right? Like at the end of the year or at the end of the half, individual contributors on design systems teams, while we know that we've influenced all of these different designers and engineers and save them time, we do have to scramble a little bit to showcase what specific things we have done to make sure to showcase that we could do even this much more next half if we are able to carve out one more headcount. And in the situation of this year, and we're entering this tech winter, it's becoming a little more difficult because in years 2 to 3, you've also developed enough trust in design leadership or engineering leadership where, unfortunately, in some cases, resources may be removed versus added. And it's what you always say, PJ, like you're always trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents, right? So we're back to that. We're back to that. Shitty point where this is what we had to deal with in year one, where you were trying to do this with one or two people. And then now you've ramped up all this, you know, system ownership. You've ramped up all of this XFM partnerships. And then now one or two people on your team, whether it's a DPM or a designer or an engineer, gets plucked to be put on a different initiative. And that becomes a little numbing and a little difficult, but not something that we can't overcome.
No, although I'm going to say this till I'm blue in the face. A recession, downtime economic slow periods are the perfect ideal time for systems. Why? Why are they the ideal time for systems? Because if you're dealing with headcount issues, if you're dealing with resource constraints, you need to eke out every level of efficiency out of every bit of headcount that you have. And what do design systems do? They eke out every little bit of efficiency out of designers and engineers. And so it may not necessarily be immediately counterintuitive, but if you math it up, there's a hell of a lot more designers and engineers that aren't on the design systems team than are on the design systems team. So if that systems team can hit an efficiency threshold, it doesn't have to be a lot, you're going to net in the black if you invest in systems and ensure that those teams are utilizing them, because you're going to get more out of the people that are doing the work. It's basic math. But if you look around LinkedIn, that is not what's happening. Systems teams are getting gutted across the board right now.
I would argue, instead of plucking folks off of our teams, why don't you bring some folks on to our team instead and see how we could help them? This is another thing that we talked about, I think, on Twitter and then also on the podcast. It's not everyone needs to be a systems designer, but if you're interested in that mindset, you could come on our team, work for a half, and then we could help you build the skills to improve in our specific fashion of building and designing.
And we've all seen it a gazillion times. You get a ton of teams that are working on different things, but they ain't that different. And if those teams work just a little bit more closely together and aligned it, instead of building five things, you could build one thing or two if you're getting funky fresh, but not five. And that at scale can create an enormous amount of short-term and long-term benefit, reductions in tech debt, frees up engineering cycles, better product continuity, less QA time, all sorts of things. And so, yeah, you don't have to, you don't have to bring in new systems designers. It's more about taking a systems mindset to the way the work is done across design and engineering. Do less in a way that can be used more broadly.
Yeah. How many carousels does Facebook, Instagram need? Probably at least 20, maybe, right?
I mean, they're all like, yeah, all, yeah.
One per designer on the team.
We live in a bubble. Within a bubble, within a bubble. And I think it can benefit us all to step out of that and understand that we're oftentimes not the target audience. I remember when I worked for a company that was in video, we had to build out parental controls, and everyone on that call was a middle-aged white male living in the Bay Area. It's like, this is a major problem. This is definitely not the target audience for parental controls. And that, I think, goes to the issue of the things that we think are important, that bespoke component or experience or pattern may not necessarily be as critical to the end users as you may think. And therefore, something a little bit more broad and or less bespoke can oftentimes work just as well, if not better, because it acts and works the same way as that gobbledygook, that widget over somewhere else in the product.
Yeah, and this is a little bit of a blast of the past, back to the future, but I do recall certain design decisions being made on the Disney video player and the details pages and the entry point and exit points of getting in and out of a video, going to the next video. And now with the child and being able to watch with the child and seeing how they interact with it, considerations were not made. Let's just say it that way. And it's difficult at times to understand and put your mind in the customer's shoes, whether they're a child, an adult, a senior, whomever this is, but put the trust in the design systems team, because we have vetted a lot of the work that we've done, if not everything, in multiple fashions, whether it's quantitative, qualitatively, and we've had components that have been used across the product that work. So you don't need to design the 21st carousel. Let's just make them two carousels and different versions and variants of these things. So there's different ways that we could make things the same, but have them unique.
Exactly. But I think going back to the topic, that is so critical to work on in the years, you know, years 2 through 3, it's a mindset shift. Oftentimes, if you're working on systems at a company, what you're really working on is a fundamental change in the way the work is done. And that's a lot. It's tough. It's daunting. But it's not just, it's components are the least of your troubles. It's the way we think about how products are built, how software is built, and how things connect. And so if you can get that mind shift growing within the company, you're 80% of the way there. You don't have to be the one always making the components at the end of the day. And if folks are thinking in this fashion, they're going to be hungry to use your components. And that desire, that engagement is gold. It's platinum from an engineering. I was on this like big speech.
I dropped something. I fidget.
How dare you, Davey?
So I have a theoretical question for you, right? Let's think about two different products that are unique but the same: Disney Plus and Hulu. They have product detail pages, they have video players, they have home screens. Should the product detail pages be the same in terms of the same amount of information, the same components, same structure? Or because they're different products, different brands, should they be uniquely different?
My take, first off, I want to just make it abundantly clear. I was joking when I was talking about Davey dropping the thing. So I just want to make that abundantly clear. But back to the question. I would argue if there's user-centered need for it, sure. But if it's just to differentiate for the basis of differentiation, even that I would say I could potentially deal with. The thing that I would start to get worried about is your differentiation impacting users negatively. Then all of a sudden I start to get really like, why are we doing this? I can almost stomach being different just to be a market differentiator. But when it starts to impact people's goals, which is, I'm going to be honest with you, it's watching the friggin' video, right? All the other stuff, it doesn't matter. They just want to get to the video that they want to watch, and they want to watch it, and they want all the UI to disappear so they can just watch the thing. And that is, yeah, I can tell you definitively, this is not an opinion. This is a fact. This is what people are interested in. And I think that is not specific to video. People have a reason why they are using something, and they want to perform that. They want to perform that task or get to that thing as quickly as possible and as painlessly as possible. And so if differentiation, at least bare minimum, doesn't get in the way of that, then sure. But I do think it's worth critically thinking through, why are we doing this? Is it valuable? Is it benefiting the user? Is it benefiting the business? Or are we doing it for funsies?
Yeah, one of the major products I worked on before joining the Design Systems team was building the video player for Disney Plus, and that had a much longer tail than the existence of Disney Plus, because we were building this previously for our company that had gotten acquired by Disney, with the idea of making it a white label player. So we were thinking from the jump that we want to make a somewhat generic. So that's a little bit of a bad word, right? A generic video player that would be flexible for possibly NHL or baseball, or this Disney SVOD service, or this fourth thing that we don't know about yet. So we're trying to develop this generic player. And 2.5 years forward, there's questions about, should we just build one player for Disney and Hulu? Should they be the same thing, plus and minus things? Because Hulu's video player, especially for live TV, possibly has five features, for instance. The Disney Plus linear player only has two features, for instance. And then how do you sort of account for that? And how do you even approach trimming, going and asking the video player teams with more features to trim theirs? That's not fair. So
this is another subject for another time, and it's probably going to be more controversial than some of our other subjects, but complexity, this is another one that I'll say till I'm blue in the face, is complexity is the rope that you hang yourself on. It's a bad thing for systems, in my opinion, because that complexity takes off exponentially. It becomes, before you know it, before you can even recognize it, you've gotten to a point where you can't maintain, or you don't even understand how the system works. So that level of complexity is something that we are almost dogmatic about trying to avoid within Gestalt, because we don't want to get to that point where we have all the things and then we don't know how it works or when to use it or why to use it. And if we don't know those things, our users definitely don't know those things. And then good luck trying to pull them out, because you got a gazillion people using that, you know, they're all using one different feature, and it's dangerous. So you got to be really careful about how flexible you make your components and patterns. It makes adoption easy in the short term, but it makes maintenance difficult in the long term.
Yeah, I was going somewhere, I think, with the multi-brand example. So in years 2 to 3, you may be asked to support another brand. You may have acquired someone, or someone may have acquired you. It could go one way or the other. How do you broach that? And from a systems thinking point of view, it's quite simple, I would think, from auditing to consuming documentation, and then trying to, from a documentation point of view, also like a matrix, I would say, trying to figure out how to best align across brands. So in this video player example, we could go along and have two different video players, but if we could align atomically the tokens and all of that under the hood, that gets us part of the way there. From a services point of view, I'm sure the engineering team wants to have the same functionality under the hood.
That's one of the beauties of a design system, is it's a forcing function for alignment. And it's going to be tough conversations early on when you have two teams that have different, most likely different aesthetic choices, different design choices, and they may really buy into it. But that is the value, is that while it may be a tough discussion, it's a critical one, because it theoretically forces teams to buy in and to come to some agreement as to what that agreed upon point of view is. So you're all moving in the same direction. And those can be, as mentioned, those can be difficult. Those can be awkward. But if you don't do it, it's worse. Because now, talk about complexity. Geez, that's bonkers if you got two systems that are kind of working in different ways, subtly, but different. It's tough.
Yeah, years 2 to 3 could also be the time, touching back on our team models podcast, where you go from federated to centralized, or vice versa, centralized to federated, whatever works. PJ is shaking his head. You want to go centralized, obviously. But this could also mean, in our case at Disney, we had a design systems team that was supporting two brands. So we had design system designers that were maintaining the Disney system, and then we had designers maintaining the Hulu system. And we would try to cross mingle them as much as we can, and have designers working on the other brand that they knew less about. But that was the fun of having two brands under one roof, and two brands became three brands. And this leads to one of the words that I think we need to say more in years 2 to 3. In years 1 to 2, we said yes a lot, because we want to be able to impact and show value. It's about time to say No. Or what I tell my son, later.
Yeah.
What does later mean? After dinner or next half? It is perfectly fine to say, I cannot take this on this half, but I'm more than happy to work with you to write some OKRs to work on this next half.
Yep. That's also a fun topic, because that's what we are beginning to transition to. And we're seeing interesting trends in sentiment because of that. They're good trends, but there's definitely, there's a cost benefit to everything that you do. The thing that I just wrote today is, loved by most is better than liked by all. And so if we have to make decisions that may not be optimal for everyone, but really nail the core experience and make it simple and fast and clear, then we're going to take that trade-off every time. And just, try to smooth out those relationships elsewhere and try to support them in other ways. But that is part of that complexity topic, that if you say yes to everything, you're going to have a mess on your hands at some point, or you're going to take on too much. You're going to get burnt out. It's going to be a mess in one way or another. And so it's an important thing to do. And it's awkward at times. It can be tough, but they're important. It's an important stage to get to, and it's important to be able to hone how you say those things and how diplomatic you are in communicating.
Yeah, it needs to be maybe a no, but, or it needs to be, let me do a little bit more research on this and get back to you. Yes, but.
Yes, but, or no, here's why. One thing I'm really trying to do is have more data, more information, more evidence than I know what to do with. So I can say, here's why we're doing what we're doing, because of this, boom, 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 boom. This leads to this. This leads to this. Here's the, every which way, being able to justify our decisions through voluminous amounts of evidence. So it's not us saying no, it's the evidence saying no.
Yeah, that's 100% right. Like, if you ask us, I've mentioned the illustrious table on this podcast many times, because it's our most complicated pattern. And if a designer asks us, why are you focusing so much on table? Why did this take so long? We could just point to the request themselves of designers asking, engineers asking for this. And it's, the proof is in the pudding. The evidence is there. And this goes back to comms, right? This goes back to, at Meta and at Pinterest, it seems like our design system teams are more open about what we're working on. On our end, our OKRs are shared. So you'd be able to see our OKRs and our team goals. And there's no effort to really purposely obscure that from designers that ask. But at Disney, for instance, it was a little more held close to the vest. So if we said outwardly, no, we don't want to work on this, we'd have to explain and really provide verbal evidence. And I could share the roadmap with certain people, but I wouldn't be able to just go and share it openly to anybody as an open document.
Yeah. Yeah. Our roadmap is legit on our website. You want to see what we're working on? It's right. It's, go to the website. We're a open book. All of our week updates are also posted on our website. And that was very intentional. It's to make it easier for us to point to a reference that anyone can go to. So there is let me delve into this a little bit more, actually. One thing that we've been working on for 3 years now is to have our documentation be our single source of truth. So a lot of our philosophy is, anything related to Gestalt, if we can get it into our docs, that will help build up the habit of, like, hey, you want to know something about Gestalt? Go to the site. You want to know about a component? Go to the site. You want to know about how to use it? Go to the site. You want to know about our roadmap? Go to the site. Bottom line is, go to our site. That's one reason. The second reason is efficiency of communication. So we can blast, a million emails out. We can blast a kajillion Slack messages out. But they're noisy, and B, they oftentimes are missed. Whereas the site is always online and you can always access those things. And then the third thing is being an open book to where, why are you working on that thing? Well, you know, we published our roadmap. These are our plans for 2023. This is the justification, or 2022. I'm already in planning. Sorry. But you know, this is what we committed to. This was the rationale for doing it. And it's an open book. You can look at it. It was published at the beginning of the year. This is what our plans are. If our plans change, we'll update our roadmap. But that is a big part of the way that we do the work is just trying to make it abundantly clear what we're doing without having to say it every 5 minutes in a meeting or in a Slack channel or in an email.
Yeah, that's something that's great on a semi-mature design system team in year two to year three is being able to write those release notes, being able to write the OKRs and the roadmap, and being able to share and really gain alignment on that. And it's not necessarily that these things don't change. Obviously they do change, and the ordering of these priorities do change from a month to month basis. But one thing that we always tell folks is that it doesn't mean that if you come to us and we can't take this on now, it doesn't mean that, you know, month five in this half, we can't take this on and sprint with you for a month. So things do change. We finish stuff. Sometimes things take longer. Sometimes things take less time. And being able to get on our radar and being able to share with us and let us share with you, and I think is helpful for everybody, because we at the end of the day, we want to be able to help you and be more efficient and be good partners with you.
Well, it's about that time, right?
About that time. Song's going right now in the background. Thank you so much, PJ, for another spirited discussion.
Thank you, Davey.